Joint Subcommittee this morning, and our first item on the agenda will be Lindsay Ball, Department of Administrative Services. And for your information, Lindsay, if you do not have a copy of the time schedule, my time schedule allots you 25 minutes for your presentation, and we will try to adhere very closely to this because we have other presentations that we will need to get in the allotted time. And members, we certainly don't want to suppress questions, but given the nature that this is an overview, unless there's a question that can take no more than just a few seconds, we would ask you to remember that Lindsay will be in front of you again at some time in the committee discussing these issues, and that would be maybe a more important format, or we could leave the director with a question and he could then provide us written responses to them. If I have staff here to distribute, I'll be part of the and with that, good morning, Lindsay, and welcome to the committee. And with no further ado, let's proceed.
Chair Gibson, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. Appreciate the opportunity to be before you today to speak about the enterprise strategy and enterprise information and strategy policy division that was created from the Information Resource Management Division. Let me explain a little bit about why we reorganized the former Information Resource Management Division. It was created in the late 80s and early 90s. If you start talking to some of the people that were working in the division, some say it was created 87, 89. Others say it was 1990, 91. And so we don't have a clear timeline as to when the division was created, but what we did evaluate as we looked at the division and how it was functioning, it was not getting the service to the state agencies that they needed. And as we started to evaluate the services that were delivered, we were discovering that the business model and the financial model that was built upon was not what was needed today compared to what was needed back in the late 80s, early 90s. And let me be specific about a couple of things that I think came to the surface very quickly. In comparing what was constructed in the late 80s, early 90s, the agencies did not have as much technical staff within the agencies who understood all the technical aspects of the data processing, information technology, and back at that time compared to what they have today. We have a fairly robust technical staff in state government compared to what we had in the late 80s, early 90s. So therefore, the agencies didn't need as much support from the technical side as compared to back then as compared to today. The second part to that was you can go out today and buy programs off the shelf that we've been writing from Department of Administrative Services, IRMD, for agencies. And we were charging those state agencies a considerable amount of money to write those programs when you can purchase those programs. So the whole programming environment has changed as well, the availability. And so we asked ourselves again, the next question was, okay, on projects related to information technology, do we need to provide the oversight to agencies with respect to project management that we have in the past? And again, we discovered that the agencies hold the skill to manage projects. In fact, Department of Administrative Services put on training for agencies to teach them how to be project managers. But yet again, we were causing them to contract with us to manage their projects at the same time while we were training people to be project managers. So it was somewhat confusing to me as to why we train people to be project managers and then continue to charge them for the services that we would render. So consequently, what we did is we allowed those agencies to be their own contract managers, so the project office was eliminated too. That came to a savings of a little over $2 million that we cut out of the program this last interim during the 05-07 biennium. Now, having said that, what we did so that we didn't leave agencies in a lurch with respect to services that they were accustomed to, we will phase out those programming services and the technical support over the next biennium so that they aren't caught without the necessary support they need for their information technology systems. But it is a step forward. Now, where are we going from there, having identified that those inconsistencies existed in the current IRMD, Information Resource Management Division? When we created the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division, we allowed the division to focus on programs and projects in the state that are a statewide basis. In other words, they affect more than one agency. And it moves the state forward in a way that is more comprehensive. I'll give you an example. E-government. There's a lot of need to improve the way we do business in electronic government today. Example. I would like to see, my ambition is someday to see the state being able to provide a permitting process where a member of the public who needs a building permit, wetlands permit, whatever it might be, to access an agency that they know they need to contact originally to get a permit, and then to find the links to the other permits that they need to get. And when they start filling the form out, they know that is the one permit, the second permit is here, and the information just is transferred over to those other permits. So that they don't have to employ a person as they do today to go from this agency to that agency to another agency to secure the permits. And then also recognize that they may have to go to a county or a city permitting process as well. Because we can provide those same linkages through the computer programming system. And then that way, when the person wants to do business, they've got everything at one spot. I think if we start looking at this through the Enterprise Strategy Division we put together, we can accomplish that task and make service for our public much better than what it has been. But we can't get there if we continue to look at information technology at an agency-by-agency base. So we split that apart, let the agencies have the flexibility of managing information technology within their own disciplines. We start looking at it from a statewide perspective, enterprise base, from the Department of Administrative Services. I can't see that we can move the state forward any other way than to accomplish a proactive approach unless we have an enterprise division as we've set up today. As I mentioned earlier, one of the things that the Enterprise Information Strategy and Policy Division will be working on is electronic government, but also security, enterprise security, how we make sure that the data that the state holds is in a secure fashion. Business continuity planning, what happens when we have a disaster, a natural disaster, a man-made disaster, and we have to restore and maintain the data and services of the state. If we work at that on an enterprise basis, I think we'll be much stronger than we would if we were relying individually on agencies. GIS, which is geospatial information systems. Currently, you will see in our budget, we're trying to consolidate information at the county level, along with the cities, U.S. Forest Service, BLM, and the state, so that we can use that information collectively. Currently, that information is housed in separate entities, and it is not widely shared. I think if we look at it from an enterprise perspective, we can consolidate that information so that all people in the state can use it to their advantage. And to give you an example of how that can be advantageous to us, we'll just use the example of wildland fires, which Oregon typically has every year. They use it very effectively in Wasco County and also in Deschutes County to watch the track of where the fire was headed. Having that GIS information locally, they were able to identify the properties and the buildings associated with those properties and get fire support there ahead of the fire so they could save buildings. Without that type of information, we would have had much greater property loss. IT investment and planning. Now, I'll be the first to recognize that I don't think we've done the best job in state government with planning our IT. I don't think it's a lost cause. I've heard a lot of comments the state can't do it. I disagree with that. I think the state can. I think we have to retool a little bit and create some disciplines in a way that will allow us to be more effective. I think from an enterprise standpoint, if we can start focusing on a strategic point of view, how we develop IT for the state of Oregon, and not be so consumed by the projects, the maintenance, individual agencies, we can do a better job with statewide type IT projects and create that level of discipline that's necessary. Now, Chair Jensen, that was kind of the focus. The first part of this is kind of the focus of the reorganization of the division. I do have about three other IT-related topics. I can break it off and answer any questions about the reorganization, or I can just continue, sir. It's your choice.
I would continue unless you have any burning questions right now. But okay.
Well, since I became the director of DAS 1 year ago, in January 2006, key members of my staff and I have worked with state agency directors and technology leaders to ensure the success of computing and networking infrastructure consolidation, which is also known as the Scenic Project, which is really now today most often referred to as the State Data Center. Information Enterprise Security Initiative, Electronic Government Program, and the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network Project. Let's go back to Scenic. I'm sure many of you have heard about Scenic or the State Data Center. And when I came to DAS, I discovered that the governing board, which was the body in charge of the State Data Center or the Scenic Project, needed to refocus their efforts and oversight to successfully see the project completed. And we had to make some adjustments associated with that plan, with that project. In my estimation, was a planning process that wasn't as solid as it should have been. There weren't the appropriate reviews and risk analysis placed before the project was implemented. They hadn't hired a project manager for the project until late, quite frankly, after it had gone through legislature. I don't think the appropriate information was shared with legislators, or maybe not, I shouldn't say appropriate, but insufficient information was shared with legislators on the validity of the project. Consequently, when we took a second look at it, the Scenic Project, without some adjustments, in my estimation, would have failed. 3 weeks into my being the director at Department of Administrative Services, identified several of those shortcomings. We then started taking action to remedy the situation, and in the March GLCIMT meeting during the interim, we delivered our plan to create a success story out of the scenic project. And we also went before April E-Board and received permission to make those adjustments within that program. Bottom line, the savings associated with the state data center will not result in savings as quickly as what was first reported and to the legislature. It will take another biennium. So a savings in the data center will be realized in the 2011-13 biennium rather than the 09-11 biennium. It certainly is the way to go. I don't have any reservations about that whatsoever. But we did have to make some corrections in that project in order for it to be successful. I don't have any qualms at this point about the project. All agencies are in the data center with the exception of education, and there are some concerns about whether or not a federal regulation will allow education data to be stored by an entity other than an education department. We're working those issues out through Justice and also the Federal Council Office. The next stage of that project will be to consolidate the information under one architectural frame, and we're working on that currently. I've been working with the Governor's Office since July of 2006. I was asked to be the provide oversight to the O1 project. I've worked with the Governor's Office and the Superintendent of the State Police and the Chair of the State Interoperability Executive Council to ensure that the O1 project has the appropriate leadership and focus to accomplish the policy directions established by the 2005 legislature in House Bill 2101. Briefly, currently we have a tentative cost estimate of $665 million associated with the O1 project. There are two phases. There are two issues associated with O1. One is we have to come up to a federal mandate by 2013. That price range is somewhere in the $125 to $150 million price tag. The rest of it between 125, 150, 200 to 665 is what we have to do to the communications infrastructure in Oregon. Let me say I put a bit of a, I guess I put the brake on that project so that we can do an evaluation of what it is we will be spending money on and what it is we will be getting in return for that. We are now looking at employing a project analyst so we can break down the cost associated with the federal mandate and the cost associated with infrastructure needs in the state so we can deliver to you a product that illustrates the cost associated with what you're going to buy. And you'll have that ahead of time before we ask you to make decisions on budget-related issues. Now, I'm pretty serious about that. I don't want to have another experience that you shared with us on the CEMA project. So it's going to be analyzed, and you will know exactly what you will be buying. And we'll work on that in the next few months. We'll keep the committee posted as to where we are. It's a big project. It's very important to the state of Oregon. And we need to spend our money very wisely and look at that not as an expenditure, but as an investment when we're done. As I mentioned earlier, we'll continue to work on the GIS utility. navigator system to consolidate the information statewide. We're also currently working on overhauling the human resource information system. We have a policy option package in our budget before the committee to ask for money to help plan that process. We are currently partnering with the Oregon Department of Transportation. They want to move forward sooner than what we are with developing a human resource information system within their agency. We are working with them to take that work, and hopefully they can break a little bit of the trail for us as we prepare the state to move to a statewide enterprise human resource information system. Now, the past year has been filled with lots of challenges and changes, and there's more to come. And I'm looking forward to share that information and also get your advice and guidance as the best route to take. With that, Chair Jensen, I'll respond to any questions that you or the committee may have.
Thank you, Paul. Is there a question? Yes, Representative Dingfeld.
Thank you. Thank you, Lindsay. I have a question about the integrated permitting with the natural resource agencies, and what's your sense about how long that would take to get something like that online here in Oregon? And I can't imagine that other states, Washington, California, doesn't have that already in place. And so the second part of my question would be, have you looked at what other states are doing and what's worked there versus what would work for Oregon?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, I cannot tell you what has happened in other states. I'm not familiar with that. I can tell you what we have done is that I put together a group of about, I think there's 9 agency directors to look at e-government and how we function in this state. We've looked at several models as to how we would conduct e-government in the state of Oregon. Now, by looking at different models, let me explain. We can do basically 3 things. We can contract e-government out to a private party, and they, in turn, collect fees on people who access the programs. There's a bill attached to it. We can contract within the state and set up our guidelines specific as to what we want, contract with private industry. They come into our facilities and work in conjunction with us inside our facilities. Or the state of Oregon can invest in e-government in and of itself so that we hold all the cards. Now, we're looking at those 3 different options. There are several states that have gone completely to a private contractor, external to the state. Everything is handled by that individual, by that company. All your web pages and everything else are all set up by that company. The linkages across state agencies would be set up by that entity. Your commerce would be set up through that process as well. Your billing notices and everything, such as that. We haven't come to any resolution on that yet. We're still deliberating over that.
How about other questions, Lindsay? Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. I want to thank Lindsay. In DAS's defense, I think in the last 5 years we've had 4 directors, or in the last 4 years we've had 5 directors, and I think what Lindsay's brought to this process is some continuity and some longevity that's really made a big difference, and I appreciate that. These issues, particularly the Owen project and the Sealy project, were really dealt with quite extensively in the technology and technology committee. Representative Dingfelder and Representative Cremel, Dahlem, and Representative Riley were all members of that. I can't remember who, I guess Krupp was there, but he's not here any longer. And Senator Morris and myself and Senator Morris Anderson and Senator Metzger came from the Senate. And there are some issues there, particularly in the Owen Project. It's a federal mandate. all the states have to do it by 2013, so we're going to have to do it. But the question that always came up is how to do it right. And so we had big issues on governments, how do you incorporate the local networks for homeland security, emergency management, that type of thing, and deal with the changes in technology, particularly when we're spending $650 million. Was it $665 or $600, someplace in that area, isn't that, Lindsay?
Chair Jensen, Senator Nelson, I can understand why you're confused, because there's three numbers that are out there. One's $905 million, one was $511 million, and what has been settled on to date as a starting point is $665 million, and that's the framework that will work in our future discussions with you. And that's the number we're going to use, break down so you know what it is that you'd be spending on different projects. Just as an example, what's it cost to set up an Olin system from Portland to Eugene? We should be able to sit down and tell you you're going to spend X amount of dollars in creating an Olin system from Portland to Eugene. And we'll incrementally split that apart for you in the analysis that we're going to be doing.
Just to follow up, one of the big issues was there's four state agencies involved: transportation, Oregon State Police, Department of Corrections, and Forestry.
That's correct.
There's four agencies, and so we were saying, how do you integrate that with all of the? There's just a huge number of local emergency management groups. And so how do you connect the two together? That seemed to be really the structural problem that we were concerned with. You have the four state agencies, you've got literally hundreds of hospitals and local emergency responders out throughout the state. And diverse geography, how do you create all those things? And so there's some pretty complex issues there, but I think there's a lot of in-depth knowledge, particularly in the House and somewhat in the Senate on this issue, so if we can draw on those people. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Devin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ball, when you talked about Owen and presenting, putting the brakes on the project, reexamining it, looking at what the true costs would be, and being able to identify those costs clearly when you come to the legislature to seek approval for whatever program is going to be put forward, are you going to be able to present alternatives also? Because I do believe there's going to be an interest in a phased approach versus a let's make the commitment today approach.
Chair Jensen, Senator Devlin, what I anticipate happening in that project is that you're going to be working with a base of $665 million. We're going to evaluate what it is that you get in return for that investment. So there's going to be options, as you suggested. Those options will come forth. You can spend X amount of dollars for this, and this is what you receive in service delivery from that. Now, if that's a benefit to the state of Oregon, then we should make the investment. If it doesn't tip the scales to where it is beneficial to the state of Oregon, then we should look at that with some skepticism and then look at a different approach. And I think that's what we'll be showing you when we break this down from an analytical perspective, and that's why we're looking at employing a project analyst at this time, so we can give you those options.
I just think at this particular stage, Mr. Chairman, that there will be a lot of questions, obviously because of some of the past history going well prior to your service at DAS, and just in terms of state government, in terms of wanting to proceed in a very cautious manner on technology projects.
Yes, proceeding cautiously, but we can't proceed slowly because we've got a 2013 date that we have to meet.
To comply with the federal requirements.
Yes.
But that's only a portion of the project.
That's correct. But cautiously is delivering to you plans that create confidence in how we're investing our money.
And I just wanted to say, Mr. Chairman, there have been some questions out there about other alternatives, and I think those will be discussed. There has been some question about how much of potential private sector alternatives have been considered in terms of furthering this issue. I don't know how clearly those have been discussed.
Chair Jensen, Senator Devlin, before we can adequately ascertain what local governments can contribute to the project and or not, whether or not there are private opportunities for investment here, we have to have the plan. And we have to be able to break this down in an analytical way so that you know out of the 665, it's going to cost us this amount in this location, like from Portland to Eugene. Now, just use that as an example. I don't know if that's how it'll work out or not because we haven't done the analysis yet. But from Portland to Eugene, it'll cost X amount of dollars. The question is, how much can we cost share with local governments who are going to receive benefit from the project as well? And then, are there any other public-private partnerships that can exist? And then you have to ask the question, do you want to put your public safety communication system in the hands of privatization, or do you want to hold that as a public resource?
That's certainly a debate that, as we get further into this, that will be forthcoming, I'm sure. And so with that, that ball, we run over a couple of seconds, but I know the economic forecast is always an easy thing to deal with, and so we probably aren't shorting ourselves too often right here.
Please feel free to contact me. We'll come and visit with you in your offices anytime you wish.
Thank you. Then we move on rapidly here to the state economic forecast. Are we substituting one for two, or? I have a time schedule on this of about 40 minutes. Present time, that would come down to about 33 minutes, please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Jensen and the members of the committee. My name is Dave Beck, Acting State Economist. I'll be shortly joined by our senior economist, Michael Kennedy, who has just stepped out to attend another important state business. He'll be joining me very shortly. As our presentation file is being prepared, let me quickly give you an economic outlook, and my presentation about economic outlook will be followed by Michael Kennedy's revenue outlook. We appreciate our opportunity to present to you our view about the economy. Apologize, this technical difficulty, but we can work off this handout. So, if you would please stay with me on this handout. At the bottom of page one, I have a presentation about economic outlook plan. I'm going to review a December 2006 forecast, followed by development since the last forecast. In particular, we're going to look at employment growth in the fourth quarter, and then we're going to take a look at what our leading economic indicators are telling us. These days, the uncertainties in the economy involved around housing sector and inflation pressures. So we're going to take a good look at these two factors, and then I'm going to close my economic outlook presentation with downside risks. On the next page, on page two, this is our December forecast. We're predicting slower growth in 2007 through 2011. 2007 will be particularly slow, and we feel that 1.2% employment growth is about right at this point, considering all the things happening in the economy. In 2008 and 9, we're going to move toward trend growth of 1.5 or 1.6% growth. The bottom of page 2 shows personal income growth. And if you look at the slide, you will see a very slow growth between 2001 and 2003. Our employment grew very rapidly in 2004, 5, and 6, and personal income growth followed. On the next page, 3. Now, we have December 2006 forecast and forecast comparison. Our baseline forecast for 2007 was 1.2% growth in employment and 5.4% growth in personal income, followed by 1.6% employment gain in 2008 and 1.7% growth in 2009. Personal income growth follows this upward trend. So in 2008, we forecast a 5.8% growth in personal income and over 6% growth in 2009. Please be reminded that we also have pessimistic forecast reflecting our concerns about downside risk, and for 2007 we had a slightly negative employment growth followed by some slow growth in 2008 and 2009. Now, since we put out our forecast, what's been happening? If you look at December employment numbers and then overall fourth quarter numbers, the employment gains are consistent with our forecast. We're calling for 0.7% growth in the fourth quarter of 2006. Employment gains came out actually at this point 0.3%. And for the entire year 2006, we had 3.2% employment growth, but that's largely a consequence of a very strong first half, particularly the first quarter of
2006. Excuse me, Dave, but the 0.3%, is that a minus 0.3% growth, or is that just the minus sign of the dash there meant to separate that?
Sure, Jensen. It's 0.3% growth, which is slightly positive. So we didn't gain much, but still positive. If we take a closer look at what's been happening in our employment front. Construction is still growing, and of course housing sector is slowing, but we have industrial projects, office projects, and also we have roads projects. And the loss coming from slowing housing sector and construction jobs is partly and more than completely offset by gains in other sectors, in non-residential sectors. We saw job loss in manufacturing, of course. We see weakness in wood products and transportation equipment manufacturing. And we lost some jobs in retail, wholesale trade. Now, this weak performance in retail trade is consistent with consumer spending being cautious, slowdown in consumer spending. If you look at initial unemployment benefit claims, they're running a little bit higher year over year. So that's consistent with the slowing job market. If you look at the personal income and wages and salaries growth, they're robust. And with income tax withholding is coming in line with our forecast at this point. Without getting into details, what the leading indicators tell us, both for the nation and Oregon, is that the economy is slowing down, but we're not going into recession. We're going to continue slow growth for quite some time. Now, what's the definition? What's the definition of for quite some time? There's a debate about that, but the our view is that we are going to have relatively weak performance in the first half of this year, followed by a little bit stronger performance in the second half of this year. This shows Oregon's leading indicators. The solid line, the thick line, is our leading indicator. It's showing slightly negative, but it is consistent with just a very slow job growth. It doesn't still indicate that we're going to lose jobs anytime soon. Now, having covered our development since the last forecast, there are two areas where economies focus on these days. And that's housing sector and inflation pressures. So we're going to take a look at what's been happening in the housing sector. Of course, housing permits declined sharply, and that leads to lower housing starts. So we have loss in construction jobs in the housing sector. The entire housing sector in the nation is in the throes of a sharp correction, there's no question about that. And in Oregon, we saw over 13% decline in housing permits year-to-date through November. One positive development in this is that the rate of decline is declining, which means the loss year-to-date is not increasing as fast as in the beginning of the year. So does it mean that we're hitting the bottom of housing recession? Today we had housing starts for the nation, and it shows positive. And home sales are improving. Home builders' sentiment is improving. So all in all, we're cautiously optimistic about the housing sector turning around in the second half of this year. Now, the more important question is, well, the first act of housing recession is there. Housing permits down, housing starts down. Builders are cutting back on production. But the secondary effects, the second act of housing slowdown, is hard to measure and may linger a little bit more. The loss of jobs and income in housing-related industry will follow, and unsold home inventories and slowing housing prices will generate negative wealth effect. consumers will feel the impacts, cutting back on consumption. Shrinking cash outs and refinancing will also slow down consumer spending. Of course, through the third quarter, Oregon home sales are down close to 20%. But median prices, median home prices are still rising. At this point, inflation pressures are not threatening the expansion. Of course, we have inflationary pressures, but there are countervailing restraints too. All in all, inflation pressures are moderating at this point. Let me remind you that with the exception of last recession in the nation, all the recessions in the past started with high inflation. So the Fed is concerned about inflation pressure for sure, and so that's why I have to mention this inflation pressure. At this point, we're talking about the Goldilocks economy. It's not too hot, it's not too cold. Now, all in all, we have to expect below trend growth in 2007, but things are improving. We expect the things to improve in the second half of 2007. I'm sure you're aware of downside risks. That's why we put out our pessimistic scenario. And all these risks, the factors, they can lead, all these downside risks combined may lead our economy into almost a recession. But we stick to our baseline scenario that we're going to avoid recession in 2007 and we're going to have some job growth, although much slower than in 2005 and 2006. And then we're going to move toward trend growth from 2008 and on. And this, Michael Kennedy will talk about revenue outlook.
Good morning. Chair Jensen, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Michael Kennedy, senior economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. I'm going to start off by talking a little bit about the 05-07 general fund revenue forecast. Obviously, that forecast has been public for about a month and a half. However, there's some issues there that we need to discuss. Then I'll move on to, obviously, what's more pertinent for this, for basically this legislature, the 07-09 revenue forecast, and then talk a little bit about lottery. This table presents the 05-07 revenue forecast that was released on December 1st. First column, the actual revenue numbers, basically the bottom line, roughly $12.7 billion projection for revenues in this biennium. 2 points to be made on this slide. The first and the second column is the distribution by source. It's widely known, but I think worth reiterating here, 87% of revenues this biennium will be from personal income tax, which is far and away the largest single reliance of any state in the union to a single revenue source. If you add in corporate income tax, you're up to about 93% from income taxes alone, which isn't bad enough, but that income taxes are in fact the most volatile of your various property tax, sales tax sources. So this is one of the things that obviously Oregon struggles with in terms of fiscal budgeting. Final column here shows the growth rate from last biennium to this biennium. You see personal income taxes up 23%. Corporate income tax is actually skewed downward because we have about $135 million in corporate tax, kicker tax credits this biennium. So if you actually took those out and looked at structural revenues, this growth rate would be 42%. Contrast those to a long-term historical average of about 12% for personal and 11% for corporate income tax. So bottom line, structural revenue growth of approaching 23%, well out of line. In fact, extraordinary and unprecedented in the last quarter decade. Which brings up a couple of questions and issues. First and most importantly, when you see extraordinary growth like that, you have to ask the question, why? Because the nature of that growth is going to have large implications for your future expectations, in particular, the temporary versus permanent nature of those increases. And you might ask the question, well, so figure out what's causing it, and that brings up the fact that one of our biggest obstacles is that there are large data lags between when the collections come in and you're looking at them grow or decline or whatever, and when you finally get the data that'll give you some insights into actually what is driving those changes, those patterns. In particular, it's the delay in tax return processing with extensions, etc., that basically give you your insights a year to 2 years after you actually see what was flowing in the door. Basically, over the course of this year and a half that we've seen these revenues largely exceed expectations, we've had basically two major assumption shifts that have affected and driven up revenue projections for 0709, and those concern capital gains and U.S. corporate profits. So I want to spend a second on those. If you were basically to take one image away from this presentation as you go forward over the next few months, it would be this slide right here. What we're looking at here is on the personal income tax side. These are net taxable capital gains for full-year resident Oregonians. And what you can see is that starting in about 1995 through 2000, there was this sharp increase, which basically contributed to burgeoning revenues during the late 90s. And it's important to point out the thinking about this point in 2000. You know, for 3 or 4 years, you'd seen 20%+ growth in stock markets, and people were questioning, you know, is this real, is this not? Basically, the thinking in 2000 was that this new telecom and, you know, computerized economy was basically producing a productivity shift in the economy, and these days we're here to stay. 2001, obviously the floor fell out of the market, and we basically were taught a lesson that no, in fact, the economy still is what it is. There has not been a paradigm shift. If it seems too good to be true, it probably is. For 2 years, and the dark line, the bottom line, I'm having trouble here with my pointer, but the bottom line is the projection as of the May 2005 forecast, so basically what drove the close of session forecast for this biennium. And you can see, at that point, the latest information we had was for tax returns in 2003. So you're forecasting out for 05 to 07, your last basically data point you knew for certain was this number right here. And we were forecasting for a modest recovery in stock markets, and then growth basically consistent with long-term growth thereafter. The light blue line is our current forecast, basically behind the December 1 forecast. And as you can see, and at this point, this 2005 number is still a forecast. Obviously, 2 years in retrospect, it's still, we are basically assuming that just given the nature of the collections growth, but we won't know until basically a couple of weeks from now what that actual number is. Note also that number is skewed upwards. You may have heard that basically Phil Knight liquidated $1.1 billion of Nike stock in 2005, obviously a huge outlier relative to the normal trend of this line. Forecast now is, if you excluded that, you would basically be looking at 6 to 8% growth over the course of time, and that's consistent with market returns in the past. As you can see here, you're talking about an additional $2 billion in capital gains between the May 05 forecast and currently. That basically, you can see this is the most significant factor behind the recent forecast revisions upward in the general fund forecast. And the point here is that here we sit in 2005. In past forecasts, we basically assumed more of this recent jump to be from temporary factors, potentially capital gains on house flipping, various other things. It's just as we've had more information to deal with, it's becoming evident that, no, this is probably more of a permanent correction from abnormally low levels, and that these are probably going to persist, these levels of capital gains, into the future. Recognize how similar that thinking is to the thinking of 2000. We think this baseline scenario is highly probable. It's based on the best evidence and the best input from all our expert advisors, but it still bears and needs to be kept in mind that still there are some similarities here. So, moving forward, the other major assumption shift here, and this graph is very similar in that it looks at U.S. corporate profits. These are for nationwide for all companies. But basically, those corporate profits then filter down to Oregon taxable corporate income and obviously Oregon tax. And as you can see from May 2005 to the current forecast, there's been a major upward revision. And this is consistent with basically what we're seeing in U.S. corporate profits. They have seen unprecedented growth. I mean, if you look at sort of the 1997 level, the peak of the 90s boom in corporate profits, you can see that that is fully $1 trillion less than what we're looking at for 2006. So just remarkable growth. And again, it's the same question. Okay, what's driving these profits up, and to what degree are those temporary versus permanent factors? Currently, this is Global Insights' forecast. Their impression is that these are permanent increases due to globalization, the effect of globalization on labor costs, globalization on other input costs, the declining value of the dollar and companies' abilities to basically hedge. And so with this forecast, basically this has been driving those increases in the corporate income tax forecast as well. But it bears in mind that this increase is extraordinary and that this is a forecast. So these are the two probably major risks to the forecast going forward. Here's the forecast for 0507 revenues and resources, and this is widely public. Basically, bottom line, $13 billion in available resources for this biennium. Modest increase from September, but almost $1.4 billion above that close of session forecast, which is then driving, obviously, the kicker projections that we currently have. Now, how has the forecast tracked since that December forecast was released? Actually, personal income tax collections are tracking slightly below the forecast. And it's been quite a while since that's happened, so it may be a sign that we've fully assimilated these unprecedented or unexpected factors and that the forecast now has assimilated those and going forward will perform more accurately. In particular, estimated payments, which were for the fourth quarter, were due last Tuesday, are flowing in now, and they look to be a little below what we were projecting. Refunds, which were generated basically with extended filings through October 15th, were higher than expected. So both of those things. But the important point here is that the revenue forecast tracking over just a short period of time, over a few months, you need to take out a lot of grain of salt, because there are a lot of shifts in payment patterns that can affect that that have nothing to do with underlying liability patterns. So we look at this stuff very closely and make inferences about liability, but you can't make a direct one-to-one tie between this tracking and what you can expect the forecast to do. Corp collections continue to outperform the forecast, although that outperformance is at least slowing a little bit. Payments are still up about 20% year over year, even as 05 returns are coming in, which should be factoring in that 36% kicker credit. So there's a little question there as to what's going on, whether those payment increases are actually real or firms are just not really factoring in their true liability levels. Corporate in particular is really interesting to forecast, because there's a lot of shifts from year to year and behavior on part of a few firms that can really swing these numbers around. But currently, just overall, looking at that, there's no real clear indication that there will be a major change to the forecast coming forward in March. So 709, the current forecast, you can see the carryover ending balance from this biennium of basically $1.3 billion, $1.4 billion. Projection for structural revenues, and what I mean by that is ignoring the kicker effects. If we didn't have the kicker, we project that roughly $14 billion in revenues would flow in to the state. Now, however, the state will be disseminating roughly $1.4 billion in kickers between corporate and personal, so the net revenue number is actually 12.6. So a total resource projection, which is widely published, of roughly $14 billion for 709. Now, the risks of the forecast, and just basically a sort of playback on the two graphs we saw earlier, here's what we are terming a fiscal recession. And what we mean by that is if, in fact, capital gains were to be lower and corporate profits were to be lower in the coming years than we are currently projecting, you could see a stagnation or even a slight decline in revenues, even as you looked out in the economy and saw no recessionary signal. You could still have employment growth growing, etc. And that is because of the most volatile, basically, factors underlying our revenue stream are not directly tieable to, say, employment growth or overall income growth. They're really concentrated at high level of firms and high level of taxpayers. So you can see the economy perform exactly as we expect, yet you can see revenues decline. So we're terming that what a fiscal recession. Now, as you add on top of that sort of the downside risk or pessimistic scenario behind the economic forecast, if that were to come to fruition, which currently has a low probability, combine those two factors and run what we'll term a worst-case scenario, you could actually see that resource number, that $14 billion, actually fall to about 12.5 or be down $1.5 billion. Now, that sounds bad, and obviously it is. It would take a lot of effort to deal with a $1.5 billion revenue shortfall. However, to put it in context, in the 2001-03 biennium, the revenue projection was for $11 billion in resources, and the structural shortfall was $2.4 billion, down to 8.6. So this scenario still pales in comparison to the severity of that outcome, what we endured then. In Senate Outlook, I was told there was some interest in the 09-11 projections. As you can see here, we have the white bar are the actual biennial to biennial changes in revenues, and then the blue bars are corrected for the kicker effects. So 07-09, we're looking at about 9% increase in structural revenues. That goes up to about 11% increase to about $15.5 billion in revenues projected for 09-11. I'm going to talk about lottery in a second, but to just combine those, there's also about $1.4 billion projected in lottery revenues. So a total lottery and GF revenue projection of about $16.9 billion in 09-11. And that's about 13% above the current projection for resources in 07-09. And going forward, basically 11-12% is consistent with long-term average growth in revenues over time. In terms of the lottery revenue forecast, basically what has been driving the changes to the forecast over the past year and a half, this chart shows year-over-year growth in video lottery sales. Basically, during the first half of 05, we were seeing in the system about 8% growth in sales year-over-year. Slots were added beginning in May of 05, and immediately you can see the impact, culminating in about 34% year-over-year growth in spring of 06. Now, as you get to the end of fiscal year 06 and you're comparing line game sales to line game sales, you expect that growth rate to come back down to roughly long-term averages of about 6%, and that was the expectation in June 06. As you can see, right after that, there was a reverse of course, and we basically persisted at 20% year-over-year growth well into this fiscal year. And that's due to a number of factors, but primarily lottery continued to add state-of-the-art games, continued to upgrade their terminals. And so basically you see this unanticipated continued high growth, and that was seen in the revisions for the September and the December forecast. However, right now, we are now seeing what we expected, which is growth to come back down to that long-term trend of about 6%. The revenue forecast or resource forecast for the current biennium for lottery, just over $1 billion, 1.1, and that was slightly above the September forecast. More importantly, for 07-09, we're looking at about $1.3 billion in resources, and that's roughly 14% growth over the current biennium. You can see that's really driven by two things. It's that increased expectation for video lottery sales growth in general, but then also the fact that there's a trigger in the current retailer's contract that the commission can actually adopt lower commission rates if sales were sufficiently robust, which in fact they have been. So that's reflected in the 14.7 administrative action number there. They still have not taken that action. That wouldn't be taken until later in this year. Now, in terms of recent tracking, basically for the first time in a long time, video lottery sales are almost identical to the forecast. So the model finally seems to have assimilated, the impact of those line games and to be tracking close to the forecast. So that's a really good sign going forward in terms of accuracy and potential changes. There's little indication even here on the video or on the lottery revenue side that there will be any major change to the forecast going forward. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Well, thank you very much. You've gotten through and you made up a little time for us, so we're very appreciative of that. I must, before I take a question, and I think maybe one question about all we'll have time for, but I must apologize to the committee. Before we began this, I failed to mention to you that this is basically something in the whole field of economics, and there's not anything supposed to be funny when you deal with the topic of economics. Some of my members were having a little humor here, and that's most inappropriate.
I think demographers are more funny than them.
Just a word of caution as we go through our ways and means process. For those of us who are here in 01, 03 and we saw a $2.5 billion drop, some of those drops occurred, a half a billion dollar drop occurred in a period of less than a month. And we can see that again. And from your side, maybe a $1.5 billion drop in the revenue is not significant to deal with and pales in comparison to the 03 era. It doesn't pale on this side. And we need to be careful and cautious. And people all over the state think we're awash with dollars. We're really back to about 99,000 actual spendable incomes. And we are not flush. We have tight programs to run. And a subtle change in this could drive us right back like we did last time. So while everyone's very optimistic out there in the public, I'm a little bit of a doom and gloom guy. I haven't gone through this for 6 years and never seen anything positive in a long-term trend. So hopefully you're right. We'll do well. But a word of caution, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bates. I'm sure those of us that were here in the 01 02 period and the special sessions are not anxious to repeat that. So we will be well advised, I think, to be extremely cautious as we proceed through this. Any other quick question?
I, Mr. Chair, I just had a quick comment. It seems that all we need to do is get Phil Knight to take that $1.6 billion and play video poker, and we'll be a lot better.
Representative, I'm not sure with the success that
our take would be quite high on that.
Mr. Knight has had. If he had the same success playing video poker, we could be in the world in trouble.
He'll break us.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, I think the turn, as Mr. Penn will show up the next thing, is the turn of money is over. It's about $10 billion in the video game. I mean, Phil Knight's a piker compared to the turn of the people are spending in the state of Oregon. It's an incredible number, if I'm right about that.
But our machines are great.
I don't want Mr. Chair, I don't want the state to get in a poker game with Phil Knight. Okay? So I don't want that to happen.
Okay. Thank you, Governor. Please, this time we're moving on to Dale Penn with the Lottery Commission, updating us on the lottery and how he's going to protect against this extremely lucky investment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is a pleasure to be here today. We have a handout to give you. Just be happy to answer questions. I primarily, with my handout, I'm just going to give a little overview of the lottery. And as I said, my name is Dale Penn. I'm director of the Oregon Lottery. After your conversation just a few minutes ago, I will note the Powerball is $205 million.
No.
Can't win if you don't buy a ticket. But at any rate, I'm happy to be here and kind of give an overview of the lottery itself. You've already heard a little about the forecast, and I have some information to give you about that forecast as well. The lottery, as you know, is a creation of the voters and is placed in the Oregon Constitution and set up as the State Lottery Commission with the really oversight of operation and spending controls over that. And over the years, the voters have changed where those dollars can be spent. But basically, they're in a situation of education programs, parks, habitat for salmon and other wildlife, and economic development. You've also reserved some dollars for problem gambling, and we'll talk a little bit about that as well. I will note that the popularity of the lottery continues to remain strong, and I think that's very important in that the voters passed the measure originally by 66%. We currently, as of just last week, have a 63% favorability rating, but we try to do studies of what of our games are popular, and that's one of the things that we continue to track as one of our performance measures that we'll talk about. The second page gives a little overview of just the operating structure. The five-member commission, which is appointed by the governor, must be confirmed by the Senate. At the present time, we have four members. One member must be a CPA and is the chair of our audit subcommittee. One member must be a law enforcement person and is also at the present time member of our audit committee. Our other members are executive vice president for Harry and David and a lawyer from Portland who happens to be our chair at the present time. We have several different divisions, and just to note that our security assistant director must be an Oregon State Police officer and is a lieutenant. And security is a very important part of the entire lottery organization, and we'll talk a little bit about that later on. You'll see on the next page is our mission statement, and it is to operate a lottery with the highest standards of integrity and security to earn the maximum profits for the people of Oregon commensurate with the public good. And that last statement is very important. Not only does it mean to me and to the commission and to our employees that these dollars go for very important programs that are funded through the legislative process, but also it is important that we sell these games and we market these games in a responsible manner. And so problem gambling and responsible gambling are very important parts of our strategic plan. We do set up that strategic plan. It's approved by the Lottery Commission every year. We have a yearly budget. The Commission just last month approved an update of our strategic plan, and at this point we are developing plans and a budget process that would be a yearly adopted budget each June. And I make that note that our first responsibility, we believe, is security, and you see that at the very beginning of our mission statement, because without the public's belief in the integrity of the process and the gaming structure and the organization, that's the only way that you can maintain public trust and confidence and sales of that product. The page 4 talks about that budget process I was describing for you, and as I said, as we received the strategic plan from the commission, we developed business plans and projects to implement those plans, a financial plan and a monthly report on the spending process of the lottery. We develop measurements, submit plans to the governor's office for comment. That budget then ultimately is adopted in June. It's a yearly fiscal year budget, and copies are then provided to the governor, to the legislative fiscal officer, and the legislative revenue officer. Page 5 is really, I think, the presentation that you just heard concerning the lottery, and is an important graph for
Ways and Means, and it just shows that transfers have continued to increase in the last several years. It gives you a three-year history of that. If you take 2006 and the projection for 2007 at this point, that comes up to that 1.26 billion figure that is the current projection, and then you see the projections out into the next two biennials. One thing to note is that in 21 years of the lottery, we have transferred basically $4.7 billion to the state. But as you can see now, each biennium will be adding to that over a billion. So it took us 21 years to get to $4.6 billion. Now, every 2 years, we'll be adding $1.25 billion to that total amount. So you can see that the lottery's production of transfers has increased dramatically in the last 5 years, and you saw some of those graphs from the presentation. It is important to us, however, one of our performance measures is to track our expenditures and to maintain as low and as efficient a spending pattern as we can, and yet still be a sales organization and aggressively present our product and transfer profits to the state. The commission has set a guideline for us not to exceed 4%. We try to stay well below that, and this year is 2.6%. You'll see in slide on page 6, this is really just a slide from the forecast that shows the different distribution of the dollars that you receive. And one of those that is very important, I believe, is the revenue bonding capability. And I'll move forward to page 7. And today, if you read the Oregonian, you saw an article, and it was reporting on your presentation in the last couple of days about the state's bonding capability. And it sounded like you had some bad news about the rating for Oregon bonds. The last paragraph of that article ever said, in Oregonian's word, a bright spot for the state of Oregon is the lottery-backed bonds. And that's the point of this slide, is that the lottery is a very stable and increasing source of revenue for the state. It does enjoy public acceptance, and it is not, at least viewing the past, it has not been affected by recessionary trends. So it is a good source to use as bonding authority. And just in the last 2 months, we have had Standard & Poor's escalate our rating for lottery-backed bonds to its highest rating. Fitch affirmed their strong rating, but Moody's, just in the last couple of weeks, has upgraded all of our bonds, and one of those bonds, Light Rail, has been upgraded to its highest rating. So that's an important thing for you to keep in mind as you move forward. I know there will be plans and discussions about using some of the lottery proceeds for new bond projects, and I believe that's very strong, and certainly the credit rating agencies have backed that. It is very important, as I said, that the integrity of the lottery be protected. And so that is our focus on security. But also, it is important that we audit, and we have outside audits. And so on page 8, we talk about the last several audits. Every year, the Secretary of State does do a financial audit of the lottery. We just received our notice for the 2006 audit that there will be no material findings or management letters from that audit. By law, every 2 years, we must have an outside security review, and I've given you just a little overview, and basically the overall review by Jetonics Corporation, who did our last security review, is that our security meets or exceeds the best practice of state lotteries. We do have, as I mentioned, an audit committee of the Lottery Commission, and we have a very aggressive internal audits program, and it's very important to us to maintain our reputation and our really view of importance of security and auditing for efficiency and best practice. I'm occasionally asked about, on page 9, the contingency reserve for the Oregon Lottery. And there you will see that the Lottery Commission has established a contingency reserve. And you'll see that both in the Constitution and in your statutory guidance, the lottery must be a self-supporting agency. We cannot receive dollars from government. And so to do that, it's very important that we have to be able to pay our way. And so the contingency reserve helps us do that. You'll note that we have $45 million in cash in that reserve. Basically, we try to keep that there at all times. $20 million of that would be viewed as our checking account to pay our obligations, our contractual obligations, our payroll, and everything else. That leaves us with a $25 million contingency. And that is what we would utilize if we have sale downturns, if we have losses, if we have problems. That is our capability to respond. If, for instance, we talk about an aggressive forecast for the lottery flattening out, that would be a place that we could go to still continue to transfer the dollars that you expect from that forecast. The last note I would make on that page is that this is a yearly issue, and it's really a timing issue, because anything that is above that at the end of the year is transferred at that end of the year. So every year, after we close our books, if there is money beyond that, and if we have an increase in sales, as we have seen in the last 18 months, as you have noted, last October, we were able to transfer an additional $26 million because of that increase in sales that we saw. But that is a yearly process that we go forward with, and that just explains what is the purpose of that contingency reserve, how it's utilized. On page 10, I will note that we've tried to pick out several key performance measures, and certainly the bottom line for the lottery is how much money is transferred to the state of Oregon. That's the reason for the program, is to provide dollars for state services. The forecast sets our target, and we were able to meet that transfer target this last year. Our percentage of Oregonians who favorably rate the Oregon Lottery, that's something, again, that is a target rate, because the citizens really made the policy choice for the lottery, and I think it's important for us to continue to receive their support, and that's something we need to track. And then, as I mentioned, we do track our administrative expenses and costs, and make sure that we're diligent in being efficient. We've also added this last year key customer service measures at the direction of the legislature, and so you will see these are ones that we took at the direction of the legislature, and we began tracking those, and that's just something we've started doing, and we've done very well with that review. Then I'm going to quickly move to one topic and then just talk about some challenges, and if you have any questions, we have to answer those. Video lottery commission rates are something that people have questions about, and it comes up in the legislative process from time to time. And let me give you this little quick history, and this is page 12. 3 years ago today, the commission rate was 32% for retailers of video lottery, and that's bars and taverns and restaurants. That was too high, and it was a very controversial situation, and there began a rate, the contract was over in 2004, so there was the opportunity to deal with a new contract. The contract in 2004, before I came to the lottery, established a blended rate, and I'm going to say there are different tiers, and I'm not going to try to explain that to you right now, but just say if you take all the sales in a year and blend them all together, what's that rate that ends up cutting across the whole year of sales. And so what happened in the new contract 2004, that rate was 28.5. So it was removed from 32 to 28.5. When I came to the lottery 2 years ago, there was one provision in the contract, and it was a six-year contract that was signed in 2004, that allowed an analysis for a new rate if line games were utilized as a lottery product. And obviously, 2 years ago, we did institute line games, and I used that opportunity to say line games are available, but the blended rate is going to be 25, and that's what we did in 2005. What did not receive very much publicity at that time was not only did the commission say it will be 25, but if sales continue to increase beyond our projections, in June of 2007, the commission will look at what is the sales amount, not the projection, what actually occurred. And if we hit a certain level, and that level was $805 million a year, then automatically the rates will reduce down to about 23%. Well, the last forecast put our sales at the end of 2007 should be somewhere around $836 million. Obviously, that's above 805. We've already begun, and we've had discussions with retailers, and are happy with this, but it's something we continue to talk about. But the idea is, as sales have gone up, their percentage will be reduced, but they're going to make the same amount of money in their pocket, or maybe even a little more, depending on how high sales go up. And since sales, as you saw, there was two spikes there, we projected that sales would go up, and we're trying to be conservative, about 27%. In actuality, it looks like it's going to be somewhere above 40%, 42%. And so this look-back rule, looking back in June 2007, will reduce commission rates again. The commission has to vote on that, but given the numbers, I believe that and I've told retailers and the restaurant association that we all have to recognize those sales are so high that is going to happen. So you see that in a matter of 3.5 years, they've gone from 32% blended rate to close to 23%. And you have to understand, our commission rate is such that the more sales you have, the smaller percentage it becomes for retailers. So you actually, as sales continue to increase, this number keeps going down little by little. But in 2010, the present contract will be finished, and we'll have another opportunity to revisit this. But we're at a number that very much starts to approach the Canadian model, which many people have said Oregon should utilize, and that's from 15 to 22 is what the Canadian provinces have. And so you can see very quickly we're going to be at 23, and we'll still go down from that till 2010. My note here is that it is very important. This is a very contentious issue, and everyone has different sides, yet it is my job to have a well-organized, productive system in operation. And one of the challenges we face every time we cut percentages is some people, because of their business plans, because of their rates of rent and everything else, it challenges them to stay in business. It is important that we maintain a strong retailer base. We've been able to do both. And I make the note that not only have we cut commission rates, but as you have seen, we will end up transferring not only the $120 million that was requested last session, but an additional almost $200 million beyond that. That's how we got above the $1 billion figure. Last, if those of you who are members of legislature last spring, you were able in special session to give $42 million to local schools. That was because of the strength of this network and the increase in sales. That was all based on additional lottery sales that took place. So I think we've been able to do both. I think we have more capabilities to continue to look at this issue in the future, but that's where it stands today. The last thing I'll say very quickly, and I'm probably right at the end of my time here, there are some challenges. So you've heard from economists talking about risks to the forecast. I want to list a few things for us to keep in mind. This is an aggressive forecast, and I think Michael's not here, but as a forecaster, you want to be right in the middle. You want to be hitting what the true action is, and that means half the time you're going to be under and half the time you're going to be above, but you average out right in the middle. He's been below where the lottery has gone in the past, and he showed you those charts. I do think his model has caught up to our growth now, as he said. And we have a very aggressive forecast. The last 3 weeks, we have not made the forecast amount by week. But overall, since the new forecast has come out, we have made that. And so it is doable. But there are some challenges out there. And the main reason I say it is that I think you can count on the dollars in the forecast from the lottery. But I do not see big chunks out there in the future because we've pretty much captured that growth we can. There will always be philosophical opposition to gambling. That is not my position to try to say that we should or we shouldn't do gambling. It's my position just to implement what the voters have told us to do, and so that's what we're trying to do. But there are times when there will be efforts to restrict what the lottery can do, and obviously when the restrictions come out, our ability to make the forecast comes into play. Sports Action and Scoreboard are two games that are going away this year by legislative action last session, and that isn't an issue for me at all. It's just that traditional games are everything other than video. So Powerball, Megabucks, scratch tickets, and sports games, those have begun to flatten for us. And so we will lose a bit of our player base. This isn't big dollars, but it is a challenge for us to replace. The smoking ban, I fully expect, will pass this session, and that's an important issue for you to discuss, totally independent of the lottery, but it will have a negative impact on lottery sales. I can't tell you how much, I can't tell you how long, but again, that pushes us a little bit to get there. We can do that. I don't mean to make a policy judgment. The governor is very much behind the smoking ban. I just bring it up in the context of our forecast. There are two major casino operations that could impact this revenue forecast, particularly beyond this next biennium. One is the La Center Casino, which I just saw an article this week. It's in Washington, D.C. It's not Oregon, but it's 15 miles from downtown Portland. 50% of our revenues come out of the Portland greater metropolitan area. A casino that close within a 20-mile radius will have an impact. But that's something we really can't control. That's out there. The article said there should be a decision in D.C. in this year. I am more concerned about the proposal for a Portland private casino. You haven't heard much about it recently. They just missing the ballot for last November. But they have been approved legally to begin gathering signatures. I personally believe that they are going low profile right now while you're in session. And as soon as the session ends, they will go gangbusters to get their signatures. But obviously, a casino in Portland, a private casino, Las Vegas model, be the fourth biggest casino in the United States, that will have an impact on our our ability to make our forecast. The last thing I'll say, because you will see Senate Bill 69, we have gone through a process of trying to upgrade our machinery. There has not been really the investments that we should have done in the past. And if you go in to buy a Powerball ticket, you'll see a little red box there. That's really kind of a PC computer. And it runs our Megabucks, Powerball, our traditional games. It's kind of like a Commodore 64. It's 10 years old, and we are at a point where we are able, and we will in the next 18 months, get a new system. It's going to be light years ahead in capability from our Commodore 64 model. It will allow us to use to develop some new games that we haven't been able to do. And as I said, traditional products are kind of on a stable or flat line, and we need to keep them going, because I think the strength of a lottery is a diverse, multiple group of games that someone can enjoy one of them. And so part of this is it gives us an opportunity, and we will be doing this in the next several months, of signing a contract. We've gone out for bids for this new system. But by law, we are obligated to have a warm site in Burns, within 10 miles of downtown Burns. You'll see a bill that will remove that requirement. At the present time, we are working with the Burns Tribe and the county, and there is a corporation that has been set up where they are interested in buying the computer center that we have out there. The lottery owns half, DAS, state government, owns the other half. And so we're working towards that. And if we're able to complete that, we would only bring Senate Bill 69 forward if we have the support of the people in the Burns area. And I think we will have that support really in the next 90 days will show us that. But then we would be able to negotiate with our vendor to have a backup site with other states and with our IT vendor, which will save us a lot of dollars. We spend a lot of money just to have the capability to go to Burns if the Salem operation goes down. So with that, the last page I won't talk about, but I always get questions about problem gambling. It gives you some information about problem gambling, and as I said, that's a very important thing to us. Not only do we advertise the 1-800 number for treatment and provide gambling help, that we don't run the programs, but we provide the public information on it. But we also have a responsible gambling message to try to tell people that, hey, set a limit, set a time limit, and keep it fun. We are only part of the gambling equation. Obviously, casinos, the internet, and illegal gambling are out there, but we are part of the gambling program that at least makes some effort to deal with problem gambling. So with that, I appreciate it. I hope I didn't take too much time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at any time or later on in the session. And thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Okay. We are running over on our time, which is against my religion. Unless there are pressing questions, we will stand in the dark.